reading from text number 2 on page 3. Sahasrapatra kamalam kukulakyam mahatparam tatkarnikaram tadhama tadaram tangsha sambhavam. Sahasrapatra, possessing 1,000 petals. Kamalam, a lotus. Goluka akyam, known as Gokula. Mahatparam, the super excellent station. Tut, of that, lotus. Karnikaram, the quarrel. Tut, of him, Krishna. Dhamma, the abode. Tut, that, Gokula. Ananta, of his infinitary aspect. Balaram. Angsha, from a part. Sambhavam, produced.
Translation: the spiritual place of transcendental pastimes of Krishna is portrayed in the second verse. The super excellent station of Krishna, which is known as Gokula, has thousands of petals and a corolla like that of a lotus, sprouted from a part of his infinitary aspect. The whorl of the leaves being the actual abode of Krishna. Purport: Gokula, like Goloka, is not a created mundane plane. Unbounded character forms the display of his unlimited potency and his propagating manifestation. Baladev is the mainstay of that energy. The transcendental entity of Baladev has two aspects: infinite spiritual manifestation and infinite accommodating space for insentient gross things. The unique quadrantal delineation of material universe will be dealt with in the proper place. The triquadrantal extensions of the transcendental infinitary field of the Almighty, unlamenting, non-perishing, and non-apprehending unlimited situations of halo, which are fully spiritual majestic foliation. This very majestical extension portrays the manifested lofty rich feature of the vaster unlimited region of greater atmosphere, which has its resplendent location wholly beyond the realm of mundane nature, on the further shore of Viraja, surrounded by the halo of Brahman, or indistinguishable entity. This majestical power of unlimited spirit emanates on the upper portion of the luminous sphere into the most charming Gokula, or eternally existing Goloka, exceedingly beautified by the assorted display of effulgence. Some designate this region as the abode of the supreme Narayan, or the original fountainhead. Hence, Gokula, which is identical with Goloka, is the supreme plane. The same sphere shines as Goloka and Gokula respectively, by its upper or transcendental and lower or mundane situation. Sri Sanatana Goswami has told us as followers in his Brihat Bhagavatamrita, which embodies the final essence of all the books of instructions. Quote, he displays his pastimes here in this land as he used to do in Goloka. The difference between the two planes lies only in their locations as high and low. That is, in other words, Krishna plays exactly the same part in Goloka as he exhibits on the mundane plane of Gokula. There is practically no difference between Gokula and Goloka, save that this, what exists in the shape of Goloka in the upper region, is the same as Gokula on the mundane plane when Krishna showed his various activity there. Sri Jiva Goswami has also inculcated the same in the Bhagavat Sandarbha of his 6 treatises. To ascertain the plane of Goloka, Vrindavan is the eternal abode of Krishna, and Goloka and Vrindavan are identically one. And though both are identical, yet Krishna's inconceivable energy has made Goloka the acme of this spiritual kingdom, and Gokula of Mathura province forming a part of the mundane plane, which is also a manifestation of triquadrantal vibhuti, conducting majesty. Poor human understanding cannot possibly make out how the extensive triquadrantal, which is beyond human comprehension, can be accommodated in the limited nether material universe of a uniquadrantal disclosure. Gokula is a spiritual plane. Hence, his condescended position in the region of material space, time, etc., is in no way restricted, but unlimitedly manifested with his full boundless propriety. But conditioned souls are apt to assert a material conception in regard to Gokula by their miserable senses, so as to bring him below the level of their intellect. Though the eye of an observer is impeded by a cloud when gazing at the sun, and though the tiny cloud can never really cover the sun, still the clouded vision apparently observes the sun as covered by the cloud. In just the same way, the conditioned souls, by their obscured intelligence, senses, and decisions, accept Gokula as a piece of measurable land. We can see Gokula from Goloka, which is eternal. This is also a mystery. The attainment of final beatitude is the success in attaining one's eternal self. The success in identifying the true self is finally achieved when the screen of gross and subtle coils of the conditioned souls is removed by the sweet will of Krishna. However, the idea of Goloka is seen to differ from Gokula till the success in unalloyed devotion is achieved. The transcendental plane of infinite spiritual manifestation, having thousands of petals and corolla like those of a lotus, is Gokula, the eternal abode of Krishna. Magyana timirandasya gyanandana shalakaya chakshurum nilatam dina tasmai shri gurave namaha. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasari Gaur Bhaktivinoda. The sun with its infinite effulgence, the image of the good soul, the eye of this world is coming through the window.
No, just the rays are coming.
Just the rays. Arajo Bhagavan Virjesha Taniyas Tadama Vrindavana. This was the opinion of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that he gave. And then that is that Krishna and his abode are non-different. Arajo Bhagavan Virjesha Taniyas Tadama Vrindavana. It is a transcendental abode, it's non-different. And in this verse and purport is being pointed out that Gokula, which is the so-called earthly manifestation of the spiritual world, or the topmost part of the spiritual world, which is Goloka. Goloka namni nijadamni chale tatasya devi mahesha haridama suteshu teshu te te prabhava nijaya vihitascha yena govindamadi purushantam ham bhajami. This is very exciting news. As Srila Prabhupada points out in one of his purports in the Bhagavad Gita, that we should be captivated by this information. That Krishna has his own island. The planets are like islands. They're floating in space. And Krishna has his own island, much the same way as any wealthy man would go out and buy an island.
Big estate?
Yeah, but he'd go get his own island, and then nobody can come out there except his friends. Aristotle Onassis had an island. What's his name who owns Virgin Airlines? What's that fellow's name? You know.
Richard Branson.
Thank you very much.
Satyanarayan.
Richard Branson. Satyanarayan? Has his own island?
He's got his own island.
I have to look into that. That's not coming from BBT money. So Krishna has his own realm, Goloka. But miraculously, it's manifested in this world as Gokula Vrindavan, and it's non-different simultaneously. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says here that it's a mystery how they're the same, but from Goloka you can also see Gokula. And he also pointed out something that really struck in my mind was that he said The success in identifying the true self is finally achieved when the screen of gross and subtle coils of conditioned souls is removed by the sweet will of Krishna. And really, like in Karma Marg, you have to perform perfectly your activity, the activities of the rituals. Otherwise, if you make a mistake, for instance, there's examples in the Bhagavatam when they were trying to create a demon that would go and kill Vritrasura.
Indra.
To kill Indra, excuse me. They pronounced the syllables improperly, and then they got the opposite result. And they got a demon who would be, of whom Indra would be the enemy.
It would be killed by
Indra, so it was the opposite way. So anyway, in many of the rituals in Karma Marg, that if you pronounce them the wrong way, perform them improperly, then you don't get any result, or you get the wrong result, you get the opposite result. But in Bhakti, it's pointed out by Kavi Yogendra that because Bhagavat Marg is a direct process, it's so dear to Krishna, that even if you run with your eyes closed in bhakti, you will not trip and fall. You'll be successful. To whatever degree you engage in that, or of course Krishna alludes to it in the beginning of the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, when he says, sualpam apyatarmasya trayate mahatopayat, that even if you perform a little bit of this, there's no loss or diminution. It'll never be taken away, whatever advancement you make on the path. So my point here is that bhakti is so powerful, and ultimately, bhaktyamam amijananti yavanyaschasmi tatvataha. It's the only way to attract Krishna, and it's the only way to ultimately understand Krishna is through bhakti. And it's wonderful to remember that he's actually a person. He has his own planet. He has his own station. And it's by his sweet will that he can pull us out of this world, just the way that a governor can stay the execution or even take out of jail somebody who's been locked up. At the end of the term of the president, he gets a sheet of paper that shows all of the people who are in jail, incarcerated, who have made an appeal to have a pardon. And he has his discretion to go down the list and check off the ones that he will give a pardon to. And other people might even object, even with good reason on legal grounds, that this person doesn't deserve it. But it doesn't matter. Like when Bill Clinton went out of office, he excused some person that a lot of people didn't like. But he had done a lot of favors for the Clinton campaign and given a lot of money, and it was his choice. He just checked it off, and that person was let out of jail and couldn't be prosecuted. And even though everyone screamed about it, there's nothing they could do because he had the power to do it, and he let him out. So Krishna has the power to let us out, and it's according to his sweet will that we make advancement in devotional service. To the degree that we have the power to lift our bead bag and chant his name, and to the degree that we're able to control our senses and enjoy some progress in devotional service, that's coming from Krishna. It's his sweet will helping us to advance in devotional service. So we should remember Krishna, and this verse is giving us a way to remember. Sahasrapatra Kamalam Gokulakyam Mahatparam Tatkarni Karam Tadama Tadanam Tam Shasambamam. He has an abode, and it is manifested in the spiritual world as Goloka Vrindavan, the highest of all the planets. Lord Chaitanya told Sanatan Goswami about the configuration of the world, how this material world is a 1/4 of the energy, and the 3/4 energy is in the spiritual world. And he told about the, of course, as we hear from that verse, Goloka Namni Nijadamni Tile Tatasya, Devi Mahesha, we're at the lowest of in the configuration of the creation, which is Devidam. And Devidam's quite a quagmire for the little jivas. We get caught up here inextricably, you know, tied to Maya, and it's really hard to get out. Mama Maya Durayaya. And then above this is Maheshdam. Maheshdam is abode of those who are liberated, but they don't have information about the spiritual world. And they stay in Maheshdam. Above Maheshdam is Haridam, the Vaikuntha planets. And above that is Krishna's own realm named Goloka Vrindavan. And one can go there. Yanti deva vrata devam pitrin yanti patir vrata bhutan yanti puteja yanti mam yajino pimam. Krishna says, you can go wherever you like. It's up to you. You decide. How you have that power, actually. You can go anywhere. And if you fix your mind that I want to go back to Goloka Vrindavan and you desire it, then how do you do that? One way. Man mana bhava mad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru mami vaishyasi yuktvaivam atmana matparayanaha. Krishna says these things. This is the way to go back to Goloka Vrindavan. Fix your mind always in thinking of me. Now these verses give a way to think of Krishna, that he actually exists. He's a person. He lives in Goloka Vrindavan, and the whole Brahma Samhita gives the information about who he is, what he does, what it looks like in the spiritual world, and we can meditate on that. Bhavamad Bhakto, become his devotee, become devoted to Krishna. Now this is a wonderful thing because we're already devoted to something. Everyone's devoted to something or someone. And what do you have to do when you're devoted to somebody? What do you do? It's kind of natural. You serve them.
Whatever they want, help them.
Think of them, help them.
Whatever they want.
Whatever they want. You just follow them around. You know, what is a devoted person, somebody who's devoted to somebody? They just follow them around and figure out how to be with them all the time. You know, somebody's devoted to a baseball player. They show up. Like, I have a relative, my wife's sister's husband, who lives in New Jersey. And he somehow or other, he became a fan of this guitar player named Akmar Liebert, who plays, like, flamenco guitar. You heard of him? He goes, anywhere Akmar Liebert goes, he goes. If there's a concert in California, he'll fly from New Jersey, he'll get special tickets, he'll plan it out months ahead of time. If there's a special thing overseas, he'll think about how to maybe show up there. And he has the poster, and Akmar signed it for him, and he has it up in his room. And, he just follows him around. And wherever he goes, Tony goes. You know, he follows him. And I was thinking about this the other day. It's like, what does it mean to be devoted? You know, have you ever seen somebody that was so attractive? Like a devotional service, you meet somebody that's so attractive, they're so powerful spiritually. All you can think of is, I just want to hang around with them. I see this sometimes, devotees that are very powerful. Like, sometimes we go to a festival, and there's a devotee that's very powerful, that's effulgent, you know, and then people just go hang out with them or her. And you just see that, you know, they're just hanging around. And there's a crowd, you know, and they're listening. Maybe that person's standing on the corner speaking about something, and there's a ring around them, you know, and they're listening. And then there's a ring around the ring, and they're leaning in a little bit more, and there's a ring around it. And then pretty soon, you know, people just, they hang in. They just want to. And with Krishna, that's what we have to do. I mean, Krishna's the most amazing person. He has his own planet. It's the topmost spiritual planet. As Sanatana Goswami was saying, as Lord Chaitanya was saying to Sanatana Goswami, that the Vaikuntha planets are unlimitedly large. He described the length and breadth of them, which is in mathematical calculations, are incalculable practically. But then he said all the Vaikuntha planets put together, they're not as big as Goloka Vrindavan. And it's always expanding. But at the same time, in Krishna's own village, it's just a village. It's a little village. That's the mood there in Goloka Vrindavan or in Gokula. It's like a little village, you know, where everyone knows each other. You can, when you hear the milk pail going in the morning, whatever, you know who's, by the sound of the milk pail, you know who it is walking down the street. And when Prabhupada lived in Vrindavan, he had a bicycle. So he didn't have much money, and he used to bicycle around different places. And it was an old bicycle, so it had a kind of a sound it made when you ride it, and you're like, or whatever. And some of the people, the sadhus who lived in Vrindavan, they could tell when Prabhupada was coming, because they hear. That's the village. It's hard to tell in a big city who it is. It's indistinct. But in a village, everything's very distinctive. You know, and Krishna lives there. You know when Krishna's going out to the pasture and when he's coming back, and all these things are. But still, it's the largest place, relatively, in creation. And then, of course, at the same time, it's immeasurable. One of the definitions of Maya means to measure. It means by the intellect, I want to measure everything, and I want to bring it down to my level so I can say, well, okay, get a tape measure. Is it this big or that big? Well, what is it, you know? It can't be both. It can't be there and here at the same time. Therefore, you know, throughout the Upanishad, the introductory to going into this kind of information we have, that tarejati tannaijati, tadure tadvantike, tarantarasya sarvasya, taru sarvasya sibayata. The Supreme Lord walks, and he's not walk. He's far away, but he's very near. Which one is it? You can't measure it. It's beyond the intellect, you know. But the idea of the intellect is, I want to control it. I want to say, oh, I know what that is. Someone mentions something. It's a, well, how big is it? I want to know, is it as big as my house? And so we want to bring it down to our level. But it's beyond that. We can't measure it. And so we can become a devotee of Krishna. And what do you have to do? Just think of him. And you can hear about him. And the story of the wives of the Brahmins who were helping their husbands perform a sacrifice. We know that Krishna and Balaram and his friends were coming through the forest, and his friends said, Krishna, we're hungry, and could you do something about it? And Krishna said, just nearby here, there's some Brahmins that were performing a sacrifice, and you can go there and beg in my name and see if they'll give you something. So they went in and they asked for some food. And the Brahmin said, kids, can't you see we're busy? You know, we don't have time for this. We're doing important things. You run along now. And they sent them home, sent them back to the forest. And they came back disappointed. And then Krishna said, now go ask from the wives of the Brahmins. But this time ask in the name of Balaram, because he's from a higher caste. So they went to the wives of the Brahmins. And as soon as they mentioned the name Balaram and Krishna, the wives who were helping their husbands dropped everything, and they began cooking for Krishna. And then they brought all the preparations out to the forest, and there's a description of how when they saw Krishna in the forest, they embraced him within their hearts, and they became stunned. And this was practically what Prabhupada describes as samadhi, how they thought of Krishna. You know, they were locked. They were embracing him, actually. And we can reach that level also. How did they come to that position? They heard from the village women who used to come around and sell fruits and vegetables. Like in a village, there's farmers markets. There's no Safeway. And, it didn't used to be. There probably is by now in Vrindavan. It's a 7-Eleven. But there, yeah, it's not called 7-Eleven. It's called something else, but it's the same thing. But in the village, basically, you know, people go to farmers markets, and they also, door to door, the vendors come. Even in South India, when I lived there when I was a lot younger, they used to bring the cow around door to door, and they'd milk the cow right in front, and then you get your milk. And so you get to know everybody, all the vendors and everything. And the way the wives of the Brahmins got to know Krishna and to remember Krishna and to think of him was because when they were buying fruits and vegetables from these village women, they would tell them things about Krishna. Did you hear? Did you hear about this? And they say, over the fence, you know, while they're exchanging vegetables. Just by that, by hearing from them, the wives of the Brahmins became so eager to know Krishna. They were thinking all the time how they could meet him. And then they got this opportunity. And then they went to see Krishna. And they surrendered to him. So that's bhakti. And this information that we're getting is so that we can fix our mind upon Krishna, become devoted to Krishna, and to remember him. And if we do, Krishna will give us special impetus how to come to him. Tesham satata yuktanam pachatam priti purvakam tadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam upayantite. He says that I'm within your heart, And when you worship me, when you become my devotee, when you think of me with love, then I'll give you special intelligence how to come to me. He'll make all kinds of arrangements. Like, Brahmanda Brahmate Kon Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Beach. We're wandering everywhere. That's what we do in the material world. We just wander from one place to another aimlessly. And according to the mode of nature we've acquired by association, that propels us to our next destination. Sometimes up, sometimes down. Lord Chaitanya said, it's like they used to have this, I guess the great kings had this torture thing down, like the Bush administration has, called waterboarding. They used to do this, waterboarding. They'd take somebody out, and they'd take them to the river and put them on a board, and they'd dunk them under the water, and then they'd pull them right back up, just like they do at Abu Ghraib. And then they give them a gasp of air, and then they dunk them back under again. So Lord Chaitanya gave this example. He said, this is the material world, that sometimes we get a little bit of relief from the material world, and that's what we take as some kind of happiness, a couple seconds of relief, and then we're dunked back under again. So he said, that's what we're doing. But somehow, by very good fortune, if we can come in contact with a devotee, then we can become freed from all that. Brahmanda Brahmate Kon Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasadi Pai Bhakti Lata Beej. Then we can, by meeting a devotee, we get that seed of desire within our heart that I want to go back to Godhead. And then the path becomes clearer and clearer because the Shastra's there, the sadhus are there, and the guru's there. Externally manifested, Krishna comes as the guru, as the initiating guru, as the instructing guru. He also comes as the Shastra. And then the sadhus, great devotees who are following the path, they also are there to help us at every minute, to give us information and encouragement. And by that way, we can actually go back home, back to Godhead. We've all come here for one reason, and that's to go back to Godhead. So now's the time to go, to make this a great journey back to Godhead. And the information is all here about where it is, what it's like, and how we can fix our minds on it. And just remembering, it's the highest goal, it's the highest destination. Samasrita ye parapalava plavam hatpanam punya yasho murare bhavam budir vatsa param param padam 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 yad vipadam natesham. No reason to take shelter in this material world, especially when we get information about how dangerous it is at every step, but every reason to take shelter of the parampadam, which is the Goloka Vrindavan. And we can do that by following the footsteps of Lord Chaitanya and the Goswamis, who went to Gokula Vrindavan. And they spent time there offering obeisances, going around Govardhan Hill. We can still do that. Maybe if the price of oil goes up a little higher, maybe we can't do that. Maybe we'll have to mortgage our house to be able to afford the time. But still, up till now, and even from Prabhupada's time, all the devotees used to go over there, and Prabhupada said, once a year, come to the Holy Dham. In fact, I was telling some devotees the other day, we used to charter a jet. We'd charter a jet, and all the devotees would get on it. You went on one? It was wonderful. Well, I must have been on the same jet with you. 1975, 4?
76.
76, I was on that. So 1974, 5, 6, and 7, it was a Pan Am jet. And half the devotees would get on the West Coast. It would stop in New York, and the other half would get on over there. And then we'd stop in London, and the devotees would come out to the airport with a big feast. And then we'd stop in Kuwait to refuel. You didn't get off the plane there. And then we'd land at Dum Dum Airport in Calcutta. And we'd get off. We were in New York, and it would be freezing cold. We'd get off from the freezing cold. We'd walk into the boiling heat. And all the devotees immediately get sick. Okay. There was no water at that time either. We were drinking out of the pumps and all kinds of stuff, you know. And anyway.
I heard they used to dance on the plane sometimes.
Oh, yeah. On the plane, on the place, you know where they have the movie screen?
Yeah.
They had that. We put the deities up there. The Gorni Thai deities were there, and we get up, have Mangal Arti, and it was very regulated, the whole thing. And on the way back one year, we had a larger jet, And so we had to share half the jet with people just who weren't devotees, who were just flying. And of course, all the devotees, when they're coming back from Mayapur, they had mudungas. You know, everyone had 3 or 4 mudungas and huge stacks of kartals that they had bought. You know? The devotees get on the plane, and they had just seen Prabhupada, too. So we'd be in the back of the plane, the whole back of the 747, and the front were businessmen and everything, like drinking coffee. And then all of a sudden, you know, someone would jump up. I remember Uttama Shloka kept jumping up and like, Nitai Gona Haribo! And then all the kartals would come out, you know, and practically the plane was going like this. And the flight attendants would go back, go, no, not again, you know. And then 10 minutes later, the kirtan would bust out again, you know. The devotees were going crazy. But, you know, going to the Dham, this is available. We can go to the Dham and walk in that dust there and see the inhabitants there who are, you know, dedicated, like tomorrow's Ekadashi. And if you're in Vrindavan or Mayapur for Ekadashi, you get up early in the morning and you'll see the stalwart people, you know, even grandmothers and everything like that, out in the early morning, barefoot, walking around Govardhan Hill, you know, staunch, you know, going around and performing these kind of tapasyas. And they're feeling it. They're feeling some ecstasy, some happiness that you don't get here in America driving to Walmart in your Suburban. You know, getting 8 miles to the gallon, stop to get a big gulp, and you know, a couple tons of, you know, Pampers and toys, and you just don't get that same bliss that you do going out and performing austerities in the Holy Dham. So, you know, it's attainable. It's the thing that the great acharyas have brought us Goloka Vrindavan, and they've shown us Gokula Vrindavan, and they've shown us the path through the way of the Goswamis. They showed going to Vrindavan, Sankhya Purva Kanama Gana Natibi, Kalavasani Krito. That they sang all these songs, you know, get these songs and sing them, and the bow down and schedule measurement and chant and hear and all these things, and the bhakti will awaken. Prabhude Jnana Bhaktivyam. It becomes excited. It's the most exciting life. Like last night at the Harinam Kirtan, you see people come around the corner when the kirtan's going at its pinnacle. And first of all, they couldn't figure out what was going on because there were 3 groups there last night. There's the Christians, and then there's the anti-Scientologists. Those are the guys with the masks. Did you know that? They're anti-Scientologists. And then there's a huge group of Hare Krishnas. And I see people come around, and they're looking here, there, and their mind's going, ring, 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 ring. But still, with the kirtan, there's something that it's so uplifting. It's so positive. The energy that's coming from the devotees is so genuine. And there was screaming coming out of the kirtan last night. Prashant was actually, I was thinking of this song about Narada Muni, where we just sang the other night, about how Lord Shiva would let out these screams during the kirtan out of ecstasy. And every once in a while, I was distributing books, and I hear this scream, and I look over, and Prashant is just going crazy, you know, and the other devotees. And it's real. It's not some, you know, hooligan yelling at a football match or something like that. You know, it's like he's feeling some ecstasy. And the people walking by, they feel that also. And so this is the internal energy descending here, and that's available to us through this process of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and the Holy Dham is there, the Holy Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam are there. So we can go back to Goloka Vrindavan. We just make a vow, as Prabhupada said, think about it. You've spent so many lives just wasted going to Walmart and doing all kinds of other things that are nothing against Walmart. Well, actually, I do have to think. But that, you know, you've wasted so many lifetimes and haven't gotten anywhere except for repeated birth and death. So dedicate this one lifetime. And we should think like that also. One should have this ashabandha, or great hope. This is one of the symptoms of bhava, actually, that one has great hope that, yes, I can, in this lifetime, go back to Godhead. To think like that. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. We can go back in this one lifetime to Goloka Vrindavan. So that's why we've come here, is to go back to Godhead. We haven't come here just to distribute it, but we've come here to personally go back to Godhead, each and every person. And so all this will be tested at the time of when we're leaving our body. It's a serious matter. And Just thinking about it now, one of our god sisters, Komadiki, is just packing it in. She's up in the Vancouver temple right now, getting ready to leave her body in a few days. And my wife was just up over the weekend to see her off. And so Komadiki, you know, she's still eating and stuff. And then she was thinking about, well, maybe she'll stop eating. But she wanted some shastra about, you know, is it okay to stop eating and drinking so that you go faster? So Nirkula asked me to find out some shastra on that. So I wrote to a few devotees around the world, and they sending back all these quotes and good wishes for her also, you know, giving examples from shastra about great devotees who had fasted till death in that condition, not the least of which, of course, was Parikshit Maharaj. He didn't take food or water. There are many others that are listed there. And it's a great, exciting thing to the devotees to see someone leaving. And it's a very serious, critical time. And we'll all come to that point at any time. And so everything that we do now is important. It's crucial. It's important. And it's available. So we should take it. And we should develop this great hope that I want to go back to Godhead, you know, and ask for Krishna's help. Because here, again, says that the success in identifying the true self is finally achieved when the screen of gross and subtle coils of the conditioned soul is removed by the sweet will of Krishna. So Krishna has his sweet will, and we know how to invoke that by taking shelter of him, especially through his devotees, performing service in that way, and also taking our own initiative to fix our mind firmly on Krishna, to take advantage of these books and remember Krishna and to hear about him and to chant his name. Especially Lord Chaitanya emphasizes Hare Nam, Hare Nam, Hare Nam Eva Kevalam, Kalo Nasteva, Nasteva Nasteva, Gatiranyata. In this age of Kali, it was so clear to me last night, I was thinking how it's so confusing in the age of Kali. I mean, you have the Christians screaming that you're going to hell, you have the and burn in hell. You're not just going to go there, you're going to burn. And then you have the anti-Scientologist, if you want to figure that one out, and then, with masks on. And then everyone has their opinion. And especially, even since I started going out to distribute Krishna consciousness, it even seemed a lot simpler, you know, starting back in 1973. And nowadays it seems to become more contentious. And wherever you go, everyone shows up, and they're all organized through the internet and with, you know, the print media and everything. And everyone has their opinion, so it's very difficult for people to discern. But when the holy name breaks through, people feel it from an emotional and from the level of their heart that this is the right thing. So many people were coming over last night and making their own choice, and all the other devotees who were distributing books last night told me the same thing. But I had at least 10 people come up to me and say, "This is much better, what you're doing here." They did, and by the way, what is it? They go, "This is good. Whatever this is good, you know. We hate that over there, and this is good." And what is it, by the way? They just know. They know that this is good. They can feel it. The holy name is attracting people. It is Krishna. And Krishna is calling people. And so in the age of Kali Yuga, we can take advantage of this and just chant the name. If you repeat the name of God over and over and over and over again, at all times and all places, the name, Krishna's name, will deliver us back to Goloka Vrindavan. And it's a special name that's been passed down to us through our acharyas that will take us right to Goloka Vrindavan. Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Goprimanande, Hare Hare Bo. Microphone? Yeah, he was just taking Charnamrit, just a tad, right? And last year, or 2 years ago, what's the name of that Swami who in Vrindavan? He left a couple days after Prabhupada's disappearance day. You know the one from Bombay?
Shri.
No? Really tall, from South India? I can't remember his name right now. Anyway, he left. He was skin and bones. He was only taking Charnamrita at the end, a little bit in the morning, a little bit at night. It's a good way to go, fast. Yeah?
I was thinking of last night after the my son, he wanted to leave the Harinam, so he was begging me. And I made him stay, and then finally I decided it was time. So as I was leaving, I spoke to one of the Christian gentlemen.
I saw you talking to them.
He admitted that he rebuked us, but and that our practice was unbiblical. But I congratulate him for going out and spreading the message of the Lord anyway. And it was on my mind that he said our practice was unbiblical. And I went to Christian school for a long time. I remember in the last book of Psalms, the last verse, it says that it says to praise the Lord with loud cymbals. And it's just like kirtan. It's directly indicating kirtan. And I didn't say that to him. I didn't want to disturb him or to challenge his faith. But I was thinking how it's completely bona fide. Even.
Yeah, it's a good point. That verse is there in the Bible.
One of my favorite parts of the Christian group was that they had this big sign that said, "Cry out to God." And I love that. We're sitting there, you know, doing kirtan there, yelling at people and arguing with people. Crying out to God. And, you know, really from our hearts, just crying out to God, calling out his name. I just thought that was something really nice that they were able to contribute to my time there, and my experience. So. And people were coming over. It was great. It's like they did us more service than harm. I mean, they, you know, were just an example of what not to do when you're trying to serve God. I mean, they are serving God in a way, but just not the right way. So, yeah, we were out there in the process, like letting people see our joy from serving Christ.
Well, there was a group of them that came over afterwards, passed back to Aunt Supriya, that had ice cream. Three of them who had been with the other group, they even had those little signs tied to their backpack that said, you know, burn in hell, everyone's going to hell. And then they came over afterwards and said, could we have some ice cream? I said, sure, here's some ice cream, you know. And one of them was blind, you know, so they didn't know what to do with the wrapper afterwards. And I took their wrappers and I threw them away. And they were, thank you. So I was thinking that ice cream's a much better path.
Made me appreciate the Lord Chaitanya's movement of being compassionate to Jesus. Mm. And I also kind of saw that what I don't want to do to others, even if somebody doesn't want to respect our consciousness, probably they don't have the prescribed glasses to see the sweetness of the Lord.
That's a powerful realization. Krishna says in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Atman Pam Yena Sarvatra, that you should, the greatest yogi develops a feeling of empathy and also sees, you know, other sufferings and learns from what's going on in the outside world, how to treat others as well. So seeing, you know, and learning from what we don't want to do and what others are suffering because of the world and becoming like that ourselves is very important. It's a nice realization. Yeah. Yeah, it's the Kurunath Prabhu.
On the other hand, or not, maybe not on the other hand, it's right that we shouldn't have that mood, shame on you, everyone's going to hell. But they're actually right.
Yeah.
God does hate sin, like they say on their sign, and that you know, this civilization really is a very atheistic, hellish civilization where everyone's being encouraged only in sense gratification and not in cultivation of spiritual knowledge. Not necessarily that those guys are engaged in cultivation of spiritual knowledge, but that, it's, you know, like Aunt Supriya was saying, Lord Chaitanya's mood, he could have come and killed everybody now, you know. Because there's the demoniac mentality or demoniac qualities are so prevalent even among all the people today. But it's nice that Lord Chaitanya's mood is to just, in the age of Kali, when people are so atheistic and sensual and controlled by passion and ignorance, that that there's this process of chanting Hare Krishna that's so easy for us now, because we can't do the severe austerities and we can't develop great analytical jnana and so forth. That this is such an easy mood that we're distributing very easily this take a cookie, chant a holy name, oh please take one book and try to read it.
Yeah, I felt the same way when Daniel and I first got out there. We could really hear them, what they were saying. I really didn't mind it so much, most of it. When they started talking about individual devotees, like Dainiti told me afterwards, Dainiti was, and I were going to go over and beat him up or something. At least I was going to be behind Dainiti. And, for saying things about individual devotees. But in general, what they were saying, I kind of liked it. In a way for myself, because they were saying, you're all sinners, you forgot God. One of them was saying he's reminding you through material miseries, that you're actually sinning, and it's not like you haven't been warned, And I was thinking, yeah, that was meant for me, I'm the one who needs to hear this. And there's one other point I was going to make. Oh, and that is that, that kind of extreme preaching, it goes on in every group. It's not that we don't have it in our own group as well. And we have to be careful of that, because there's a spectrum of faith, and there's a tendency when somebody joins a faith and imbibes it in a certain way to be inflexible and sort of pound people with it rather than learn how to attract them or to give it to them in a compassionate way. And that can happen even, and has happened, and probably still is, if you're on the internet. You go look around at, how some people who are supposedly Vaishnavas are preaching to others as well. It's the same tone. And so we have to be careful not to become, get caught in that kind of preaching on either side. Krishna Maheshwari Prabhu, microphone's coming.
Just, I guess, a short comment. Bhagwan doesn't hate anybody. He doesn't hate it if you quote-unquote sin. In Narashastra, there's not even a concept of sin itself. And it's really, we had a wish to be separate and to enjoy, and it was his compassion and his love. He said, okay, go enjoy. It's a totally different thing that our wish was ill-advised and a bad idea, and we're now realizing it. But, Bhagwan is compassionate, that there is no hate. That just does not exist in Golok Vrindavan. And it doesn't exist in a Supreme Personality. It's just not there. And so when they say, you will go to hell and all that, well, it may be correct at some level. In terms of Bhagwan sending you there, that's not true. We're taking ourselves there, and we're trying to pick ourselves back up.
Mm-hmm. Nice point. Difference in theology. In that sense, probably gives the analogy when you come before a high court judge, and he says, 10 years, you've got 10 years. Is it his fault or is it your fault? You're the one who transgressed the law. You knew it, you did it. Now that, you say, well, the judge is bad or he hates you or something. It's like, no, he doesn't hate you. He's part of the government. He's trying to help you. But because you chose to do that, therefore you've at your own risk. Prabhupada said that the material world meant enter at your own risk.
That we're reading chapter 5 this week. Now, that day, Kashyachit.
Microphone.
In chapter 5, Krishna says that he doesn't assume the pious activities or the sinful activities of the people, that it's not his fault, even though he also says in the 16th chapter, Kshipyam yajastram ashupan
ashurashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayvashvayv
puts them in demoniac species, and they just develop their envy more and more, and they go, you know, until he comes by and kills them. That's their mercy, you know. That's his mercy, that when he kills them, he liberates them. But it's not like, it's not his fault. It's that he's equal to everyone, and he's responding to the to, because these living entities have these particular desires, then he's giving them these asuric bodies and everything. And then he, you know, he appears to favor the devotees, and he also appears to become angry with the demon. He always protects the devotees. He does actually favor the devotees at the same time being equal to everyone, which is sometimes a paradox. But he always protects the devotees, and therefore he despises those who disturb the devotees.
Milan.
Question which often comes to my mind now that we are on this topic. I mean, I often wonder, you know, why did Krishna create so many different faiths? You know, which fight with each other? I mean, eventually, even everyone says, go to the Father or go to Allah, or, you know, whether Krishna is around that Father or around that Allah. Or, I mean, one may argue that different mentalities are there, so Krishna has different faiths, they create different faiths. But eventually, there's so many faiths are fighting with each other. You know, I know atheists saying that we just don't believe in God because look, what is this happening? You know, a group of faith just wants to convert the whole world and that is leading to terrorism. So many problems just occur because of different faiths. So.
Well, let's see if we can draw Satyadeva out this morning with that question.
Well, that's why Vaishnava was making the point that even within Krishna consciousness movement, we have to be careful about how we're presenting our faith to others, and as much as possible not appear in that sectarian mode, you know, because really it comes down to, when you say the word faith, just the word itself means actually that you're in a situation that you don't know something, that you're believing it, but you haven't actually experienced it yourself. So that word sort of denotes a situation of unknowingness. And I think the motivation that comes out of that is a kind of fear. And because one is not sure of oneself, then he's very uncomfortable around others who don't believe like him. So that's where this pounding mentality comes from, because actually the person within themselves isn't sure of themselves, and that's motivating them to try and force others to be like them, because they don't want to confront that uncomfortable feeling they're having within themselves. So we want to avoid that, and we want to be sure what that is and where it's coming from. But it's true. It's an argument that especially nowadays is that, you know, times change. So that is like forefront in the minds of the mass of people these days, that they're seeing different religions fighting and killing each other. You know, the Jews against the Christians, and Christians against the Muslims, and so they say, what's the difference between you and them? You know, if we have that kind of mentality. But like Vaishprabhu was saying, that we should be presenting, that there's one God. And we should be presenting universal principles, you know, and approaching people on that level, especially if they don't accept Shastra. Especially people tend to reject Shastra because of the contradictions they see between the different Shastras, or actually there's no contradiction, there's just a contradiction in their presentations. So we have to be sensitive to the times and present Krishna, present Bhagavad Gita, and like Prabhupada did, in a very scientific way, not in a religious or fanatical way, but just point to the universal truths that are there. And say, just because people are fighting doesn't mean that there isn't still God and there still isn't reactions for your activities.
Thank you. There's also a discussion. Arjuna asked a similar question in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita about how the divisions of faith. And why are there different divisions of faith? And Prabhupada talks about this, about how there are different kinds of religious practice in the world. And the essence of that explanation that Krishna gives is that there's a pure faith, which is faith in God. This is explained in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Shraddha Shabde Vishwas Kahi Surida Nishchoy Krishna Bhakti Koila Sarva Karma Krita Hoy. That when we are have pure faith, we have a clear understanding that I have an eternal relationship with God, and that I'm not my body, and that I have no connection to the nomenclature of the material world. I'm only dependent on Him. And that if I act in that capacity, then there's no problem. There's nothing else needed. When I'm covered by one of the three modes of material nature, one of the combinations or permutations of the three modes of material nature, then my faith becomes tinged or colored in different ways, so that I have what is called upadhi, or designation connected to it. That is, I'm connected to God because I'm an American, or because I'm white, or something. I mean, there actually are people who have faith. Faith is there in everybody, but their faith is that you have to be white, the white Aryan nation, only Jesus Christ, who apparently they think was white also, it was, they have this, they concoct all different things, and you look
they're
at
not
these.
They're not really Aryans.
Yeah, they're not really Aryans. So there's there are many, many different kinds of faith that are tinged by the modes of material nature, Krishna says in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And the definition of actual bhakti or faith in wherever it is, sarvapadi vinirmuktam taparatvena nirmalam rishikena rishikesha sevanam bhaktir uchite. That what bhakti is when you become free from those designations, the external bodily designations based on the three modes of material nature, and you become completely aware that you're of your eternal relationship with God, and that He's the master of your senses, and that you engage in service to Him all the time. Bhayasparshe swasakta ma vindityatmani yatsukam. For a person who's in that condition, Krishna says in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the practitioner becomes happy within himself, completely self-satisfied, and not angry at everybody else for differences in faith. And in fact, somebody who's on the highest level, sarva-bhuteshu yapashyed bhagavad-bhavam-atmanaha bhagavat-yutama bhagavat as a Sarva Bhuteshu Yapashyed Bhagavad Bhavamatmanaha Bhutani Bhagavat Yatmani Esha Bhagavatotamaha. The Bhagavat Uttama, or the highest level of a person with faith, is that he sees everything connected to Krishna. He sees everything in relationship to God. And his mood is Bhagavat Bhavamatmanaha, to engage it all in Krishna's service somehow or other. And then the person on the lowest level, on the other hand, says, Acharya meva hareye pujamya shradaye hate natad bhakteshu chanyeshu sabhakta prakrita smritaha. This is called the lowest kind of devotee. Talking about any so-called religious practice. And that is that God's only here. He can't be anywhere else. He sees God. He sees that there is an Ishvar. But then he mistreats everybody else because he thinks that they're not connected somehow. He doesn't see the connection. So seeing the connection between between God and all living entities is a symptom of someone who's very advanced. And someone who sees like that, Krishna says, Vidya vinaya sambhane brahmane gavi hastini shuni chaiva shopake cha pandita samadarshina. The learned person sees with equal vision a cow, an elephant, a dog eater, an outcast, and a Brahmin. He sees that they're living entities, they're connected to Krishna. So it's a matter of enlightenment and freedom from the conditioning of the modes of material nature in any particular religious tradition. And you can read about it, you know, there's a spectrum. You see those guys last night and how what their presentation is of Christianity. And then there are more enlightened mystics in Christianity who you might read their writings, and they'll see the brotherhood of all people. They'll see how all different religious traditions are actually connected, and you know, have a sense of compassion for other living beings and so on. So it's a matter of advancement, really. And as I said before, and we're talking about, it's not that we, you know, we have ISKCON, and therefore, because you're a member, therefore you're going back to God and everyone else is going to hell. That's the same thing that they're preaching. It's dependent on your advancement and how you've taken advantage of the order of your spiritual master. Are you a cheater? If you're a cheater, then you're going to cheat others. You know, and if you're sincere and you're pure, then you'll be able to imbibe it, and you'll be able to pass it on to others also in a way that will be effective. Fair enough.
Just in response to Milan's point, though, well, why doesn't Krishna say, you know, Allah is really me, and you know, the God, the Father of Jesus is really me? I mean, he does say that. It's the Bhagavad Gita was before these other faiths, you know, before Jesus, before Muhammad. But Krishna, in the ninth chapter, he talks about, you know, yepyanya devata bhakta yajante shrapayam vata tepi mame vakonkera yajantya vidhi porvakam jnana yajena chakyena ekatvena pratakvena bahudabhishvitova. There's different kinds of people, you know, who are cultivating knowledge that worship Krishna as the universal form, or as worshiping the demigods, or as the impersonal feature of Krishna, and that those who worship other gods, anything, whatever you worship really, how can it not be Krishna? Because, you know, Krishna is the source of everything, but you may just not understand how it's Krishna, and therefore you're worshiping in a wrong way. Not that we're criticizing the way these certain other groups are worshiping, but Krishna is saying that those who worship the demigods, for example, are really worshiping him, but because they're doing it indirectly, it's in the wrong way.
Krishna Heshwari Pool.
So there's a couple of different ways to look at it, and I'll let some of my more materialistic side come out as part of this discourse. When you look at it and look at these religions and religious groups, there's a couple of ways to look at it. We've been discussing it from a very spiritual aspect. From the materialistic aspect, Christianity and Islam even more so is a political construct. If you look at it, if you look at anyone who's analyzed the scriptures and you look at what they've seen, I mean, I've read the Gita, I've read a lot of Arshastra. I've read bits and pieces of the Quran and bits and pieces of the Bible. But I've read a lot of people who've analyzed both of those scriptures. And you've looked at it. And you look at that. There's 13 years that we're missing out of Jesus' life. People suspect he went to Kashmir and got training from Kashmiri Pandits. But when was the Bible written? How many years after Jesus passed away?
200
years. That's 200 years where jivas who are living in the materialistic world were organizing a political construct called Christianity, and you don't know how authentic the Bible is compared to what Jesus said and compared to what Jesus was trained in himself. So there's a gap. Similarly, if you look at Islam, and a lot of the stuff I've read about Islam and about Muhammad, I can't repeat in front of the deities. I can't repeat in the street. Talk to me outside. Okay, and that's how disturbing it is. But if you go and read it and you say, okay, what happened? My best guess, he somehow got a glimpse of the ultimate reality and went insane because he wasn't ready. But at the end of the day, Islam is even stronger a political construct. You know, no matter what supreme truths are hidden in the Quran, when you look at it as a practice as a whole, not just little bits and pieces, you know, there may be some self-realized people somewhere in the middle. If you look at it as a whole, you get a very different impression. Okay, look at what's happening in India, look at what's happening in the Middle East, look at any country in this world where Muslims are a small part of the population. The first thing they do is give us equality. As they grow, it's more about equality. The moment that tipping point appears, they're beyond 51%, equality is gone. It's, this is how it will be. Everyone else, off with their head or follow what we preach. You not only see that in the Middle East, you see that in Bangladesh, you see that in Pakistan. And, you know, the small bits I was talking about, you see in the Netherlands, with what happened when people published the cartoons about Muhammad. Do you know what the Islamic people publish about everyone else and the cartoons they publish about everyone else? No, that's about political correctness. That's about equality. They have a secret, a sovereign right to publish that stuff. Look at Wikipedia. Someone published, you know, they wrote an article, they put a picture. And what happened? They got a petition with over 100,000 people who signed, please take it off, it's offensive to us. There's a video that was made by a member of the Danish government. The Danish government itself, for fear of what would happen in the country because of the percentage of Muslims that are there, and it's a relatively small percentage, they said, we will not post it. We will not allow it to be published in video, in film, in the cinema, or on TV. In the end, he found a website in the UK who would host it. 2 days later, they had to take it down, and their explanation was, we believe in our right to publish it, but we have to take it down for fear of security of our staff. A week later, they put it back up, and again, they apologized, and they said, we've now arranged for the security of our staff. We can host it. So, you know, that is the political reality that you have to keep in cognizance when you're looking at these things. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are said and done, but at the end of the day, those things, you know, and I'm going to summarize it by saying Abrahamic religions, which is kind of the collective group, and make a more general statement, they do not acknowledge the Veda, which is the Shastra that Bhagwan handed down, and through which we have the Gita, which we read every Sunday, and hopefully more than just every Sunday. That is not accepted as valid truths. You know, Sarva Dharma Parityaja, you know, that entire verse, and I don't have it by heart, but Bhagwan says, give up all your dharmas and come into me. And at that time, when these other religious groups weren't there, what were the dharmas he was talking about? You know, that's one thing to think about. The other thing is, are these other groups, are they really dharma? Are they describing a dharma? And the answer is no. They're not describing a dharma. They're describing a religion. And the two are fundamentally different. You know, you can write books on the definition of both those words, but they don't equate. And so you have to take all of that into account when you try to understand some of these things that you were asking about.
Thank you, Krishna Maheshwari.
Yes, I'm just going to make it. I'm just going to make a general point as well, because I was having a lot of arguments with different, to do with religious debates, and you know, different people with different religious perspectives on Wikipedia. And then I spoke to my sister about 2 weeks ago, and then she was describing virtually the same experience she was having, but on a website about how to raise children. To say, some mothers were saying, when a child cries, you have to get to it straight away, pick it up, because otherwise it psychologically sort of becomes like weakened when it grows older. And then there was others that were saying, when a child cries, you should just leave it. And she was saying that they were fanatically arguing on both sides, whether you should pick it up or whether you should leave it. So I was thinking practically every, like almost all subject matters in today's Kali Yuga, there'll be someone who wants to argue like fanatically about, you know, one opinion or another. So I was just thinking again, you know, you can apply it to religion as well, or you can apply it to practical religion.
You'll find that, of course, in any realm, especially in the age of Kali Yuga, that everyone assiduously sticks to their opinion. And, you know, part of the way of success, even in ISKCON, you have to find your niche, really, and a place where there are like-minded devotees. In fact, this is mentioned in Shastra, that you should find devotees who are like-minded, have a similar kind of faith. And Prabhupada also wrote a letter, which is now famous. Well, I should say it's well known to devotees, because one of the leaders at the time was complaining that the GBC and different leaders in ISKCON were arguing and, you know, couldn't agree on certain things. And Prabhupada wrote back a letter, a apparently this person was saying that, you know, why can't we all just get along? Isn't this like Mayavad or something that these devotees are arguing all the time? And Prabhupada said, no, quite the opposite, actually. He said, don't expect utopia, even in the spiritual world. He said the reason that there are differences of opinion is because we're all individuals. Just as Krishna is abhijñān swarāt, he's supremely independent and fully conscious. Similarly, we're minutely independent, and we're also conscious. And we have our independent wills. And there's a way in which, even in a purified state, devotees may have some difference of opinion on methodology and such. However, they agree on the center, which is Krishna. In Vaikuntha, it's not that people are merged and, you know, they're zombies or something. They're all enjoyable and tasty. Part of being enjoyable and tasty means there's some difference of opinion. That's what makes things really interesting. But it all culminates in an understanding of surrender to Krishna. So anyway, in the letter, Prabhupada advised him that actually it's Mayavad to think that everything's the same, or that we should all just live, that we'll all come to a point of living in harmony and have no difference of opinion whatsoever. But you'll see that even in the commentary of the great acharyas. You know, one acharya will say it's like this, and then Sanatan Goswami, as an example in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, will say, but then another acharya said it could be like this, and it could also be like that, it could also be like this, and it could all. The spiritual worlds, there are unlimited possibilities, it's unmeasurable. Of course, through the intellect, I want to say, no, it has to be in a certain way. I have to define it, you know, so I can control it and say, no, it's like this. Put it in a little box. So there's, practically speaking, even in a great society like ISKCON, International Society for Krishna Consciousness, we also have to find our niche. Even maybe within the same geographical area, there may be two temples that have a completely different mood. Right, Bhakti Daniel? He goes to between, you know, the Berkeley Temple and the San Jose Temple, and he likes them both, feels at home both, but if you talk to him about it, he'll tell you that they're different moods, right? Yeah, and anywhere else you go in the spiritual realm. You go to South India, and they worship Krishna in a certain way, and you go to North India, and they say, no, you know, we give him this, you know? You go to Govardhan, you know, in South India, there's a big offering and bells ringing and things like that. And I saw once out of Govardhan, one family who lived at Brajabasis, they're feeding Krishna. They just take the sweet rice, put it in front of them, and go, eat, eat, you know. That's how they offer this. Like, come on, you know, hurry up. In South India, it's, you know. It's the same offering. It's offering to Krishna, but different moods according to their, you know, according to their faith. So the spiritual world is unlimitedly variegated. And there's no particle in creation that's the same as another. And there's no living entity that's the same as other. All have an individual. That's what's Ananda. It's unlimitedly, when you think about it, how God's created all these parts and parcels who are simultaneously one and different. And they all have their individualized. That's what we were saying the other night. They're all individualized consciousness. So that's amazing. And that's something to think about. Yes?
I think that's what I appreciate.
Could we have the microphone over there?
I think that's what I appreciate, having the Mahajanas or the Acharyas in North Sampradaya. Because then I kind of feel like connect my consciousness where I find my niche, the inspiration to find those acharyas or find the shelter and see the world as they have seen. I don't know how that statement goes, but see the world as it is or see the world as you are or something like that.
Atmanamnate jagat. According to how, what your consciousness, you project it into others and the whole rest of the universe, you see like that.
So that's how to otherwise, I just see this world is such a loop that you can't just get so lost.
Yeah, ultimately Lord Brahma, of course in his prayers, he's the most intelligent living being in the universe. And after he tried to measure Krishna and control him, you know, and see, is he really, is that little child actually Bhagavan? Is he actually the Supreme Ishvara? And he said, well, I'll just try a trick on him and see what happens. And then after Krishna revealed how he had expanded himself into the exact calves and cowherd boys, and then he manifested that each one of them was actually a Vishnu expansion, and they were all coming out of his body, actually. He was emanating them. He gave up all of his, you know, ideas to speculate or try to measure anything, and he just said, others may say that they know you, but I don't know. I don't know anything. And even if it comes to the point where you can count all the stars in the sky through using a high-speed laptop computer, or, you know, the grains of sand and all these things, he said, still, your qualities will be unknown. Impossible. Dainiti Prabhu?
Yeah, I'm wondering about how do we, you know, we have a mood here in San Jose, and so, you know, there's a different mood in Berkeley. And then further than that, there's different Vaishnava groups, and then further than that, there's different, you know, Christians and Muslims. So how do we, you know, we have a certain mood, so how do we treat all the other groups? I mean, we don't understand their mood, but we accept their mood. How do we accept someone who we really don't understand their mood without, you know, how does one, is it just accepting their mood that we don't understand it? Or
it's explained in the out of the three verses, I gave two verses that were explained in the 11th canto that talked about the most advanced devotee sees everything in relationship to Krishna, and then the least advanced devotee who only sees that God's in my temple or mosque, and then everyone else can just go to hell. And then there's the intermediate devotee called the Madhyama Adhikari. Ishvare tara dineshu bali sheshu dusatsucha prema maitri kripopeksha yakaroti sam madhyamaha. So this is the explanation of how you should treat others. And it's given in four parts. There are four entities generally that you see. First is Ishvar. That means God. And so towards Ishvar, prema. It means you show love. Then there's the adineshu, which means those who are worshiping God, the devotees. And for them, you show friendship. Then there's the bali, which means they're innocent. And for them, you show kripa or mercy. And then there's dvisatsu, which means envious. And for them, upeksha, you show neglect, means stay away. So there's discrimination. And what is somebody who's innocent? See, that's a quality that you have to tell for yourself. Like, I was thinking about that last night, Hare Krishna, that when, you know, people are walking by and you stop someone, it's something you can actually feel whether somebody's envious or not. It's not like they fill out a form and, you know, it's like you look at it and go, okay, you're innocent, you know. But you could feel it. You know, it's something you see in people's eyes or, you know, you feel coming from their heart that they're envious. It's something that, you know, they may not spit fire at you, but, you know, they can emanate something where they really, you know, hate God or they hate the idea of it or something like that, you know. And for the envious, you want to just give them a little space, you know, go around them like that. You know, you can see they're part and parcel of Krishna. They're still on the tree. They're getting, you know, they're going to get the reaction or whatever it is. You don't have to, you know, scream at them and tell them you're going to hell. But you could just give them a little space. And if they would take some prasadam, then they could take some ice cream and cool them down a little bit. But, you know, and for the innocent, you can tell them too when they come in. So it's the same in every group. And if you go, you know, if you go in other circles and to other organizations or whatever, you're going to find a spectrum of people who may, you know, be within those categories. That's in a general way.